Welcome to Inclusion Catalyst with your hosts, Mickey Desai and Susan Cooper. We invite diversity leaders to the table to deconstruct complex social justice issues and showcase the best inclusion practices in our workplaces and our communities.
Hello, this is Mickey Desai. I'm your host for this episode of the Inclusion Catalyst. I'm very honored to be sitting here with Mary Frances Winters, who is a celebrity in the diversity and inclusion sector with over 36 of experience in the field. Mary Frances was named a diversity pioneer by Profiles in Diversity Journal. She received the Winds of Change Award from the Forum on Workplace Inclusion. She's been featured in Forbes publications at least twice, once as being named as one of DC Metro's area's most powerful women, and as being named by Forbes as one of the top 10 trailblazers in diversity and inclusion. Ms. Winters is also an author several times over, and I hope we get to spend some time talking about her latest work called Inclusive Conversations, Fostering Equity, Empathy, and Belonging Across Differences. How are you, Mary Frances?
I'm doing well. How are you today?
I'm good. Thank you. Did I get the title of the book correct?
Yes, you did. Absolutely.
Great. I think let's just start our conversation talking about that. Why did you write Inclusive Conversations?
I wrote Inclusive Conversations, Fostering Equity, Empathy, and Belonging Across Difference because I think that we have a difficult time talking about topics such as race and gender identity, and we need to talk about those topics if we're going to create inclusive environments. I wrote a book in 2017, which did very well, called We Can't Talk About That at Work, How to Talk About Race, Religion, Politics, and Other Polarizing Topics. So this book goes deeper than that book, and it lays out some conditions that we need to have in place in order to have inclusive conversations.
Yeah, and I saw that. You sent a little preview material, and I like the fact that it really does get almost on a very granular level how to look at specific circumstances and with some solid suggestions on how to handle each of those circumstances. You know, we've come a long way. Diversity and inclusion has been on the forefront of a lot of what happens in the corporate sector these days anyway, in terms of teaching people how to relate to each other and how to talk to each other. But I do have what may be considered a not very nice question, which is how did we land ourselves here? How, after all these years even, have we got a corporate culture in front of us that has become so stiff that people simply don't know how to talk to each other?
Yeah, thank you for that question. I think that one of the things is that we have people afraid to have the conversations because there's this cancel culture, particularly in the social media space. If you say the wrong thing, then, oh my goodness, you know, the righteous indignation. How could you have said that? And I think one of the chapters in the book is called, Let's Extend Some Grace and Forgiveness, because everybody doesn't know everything that's going to make someone else perhaps feel uncomfortable or that's going to be insensitive. Perhaps we should know, but we don't always know. And so I'm all for let's look for the teachable moment as opposed to the punishable moment.
Ah, I see. Yes, that does make a whole lot of sense. It does seem like social media is more quick to condemn than it is to forgive.
Absolutely. And, you know, there are a lot of things that we just don't know. There's a lot of history that was really left out as we were growing up. History is the interpretation of the person writing the history, correct? And so, you know, I think that we have to, if we really want to create an inclusive world, we have to learn, we have to unlearn, we have to be teachers, we have to be students.
Right. And as I've heard other people say, the art of empathy really is sort of a two-way street. It can't really be one-sided.
Exactly. Yes. And in the, I coined the phrase reciprocal empathy.
Ah, okay. I'm writing that down. Reciprocal empathy. What do you mean when you say reciprocal empathy? What does that look like?
So as you just said, it always looks sort of one-sided, right? I want you to empathize with me, perhaps those of us who are considered historically underrepresented or historically marginalized groups. But I think that we have to empathize with those who might be in the dominant group, you know, as well. We're not going to get anywhere with our conversations if it's one-sided or if it looks like I'm the one expected to, you know, apologize all the time, know it all. And I think it has to be reciprocated. I have to have empathy for someone who perhaps just doesn't have a clue because they've never had that experience, but they're willing to learn.
Right. And I think for me, at least, the key part of that is the willingness to learn. One of the questions I have for you is, how do you talk to folks who aren't really interested in talking, right? How do you foster conversations with people who are not really there to converse?
You don't.
Okay.
quite simply, in order for inclusive conversations to happen, mm-hmm. both parties need to be interested in having that conversation. I say that, you know, let's spend our energy on those. There are lots of individuals who want to have the conversations, who just maybe, again, may not have the, you know, may not have the knowledge about what it's like to be, you know, someone who has a physical disability, what it might be like somebody who's in the LGBTQ community. I just don't know. So there are plenty of people who are curious and want to know. Those who are not interested, I say, let's not spend our energy there.
Right. So perhaps the mistake I'm thinking here is thinking of all the so-called conversations that I see happening on social media. I mean, I think that's where a lot of quote unquote communication tries to take place. And yet I'm seeing a lot of people who are ready to show up and do some screaming, but not really do any real listening. And that's why I asked the question. It's like, what do you do if you find yourself in that circumstance where you may post something that says, here's this image or here's this quote that has something to do with the way that I feel? And then, of course, social media being what it is, someone else may jump in and say, but here's some evidence that proves otherwise, and this is why you're not very smart, right? And
right. Yeah.
And so then what do you do? Where does that conversation take place where you run into that circumstance when clearly people aren't really listening to each other? And I think you just answered the question. You don't.
I'll modify that just a little bit. The book, Inclusive Conversations, I do talk about how on social media we can be more inclusive, more, you know, practicing reciprocal, you know, empathy. And I think one of the things that I say is that the person who perhaps has a disagreement with, let's say somebody posts something and you look at it and you say, oh my gosh, how could somebody have even said, how can anybody even believe that? And so I would engage then, rather than saying, you know, you're a stupid jerk, or say, gee, that's really interesting. Can you tell me more about where that worldview came from? I'd like to engage in understanding where that worldview came from. So again, curiosity rather than judgment, at least initially. Sometimes what that does is it disarms the individual to say, well, gee, I guess I'm not really sure where that came from. That's what I just always believed. That's what I just always thought. Right. And so now you're that person is questioning themselves because you haven't really put them on the defensive. You said, I want to engage you. I want to call. In the book, I talk about calling people in rather than calling people out.
Ah, that is brilliant. Yes. Yeah. And that is, yeah, okay. I was thinking what you said is also very similar to the way we kind of approach it in therapy, which is not only does it help if the person has an inkling that they actually need to change, but most people just really want to feel heard and validated, and maybe it's okay to offer someone a little flash of forgiveness and give them that moment of grace in the interest of preserving a larger conversation.
Right, exactly.
Is it the same thing? Does it work the same way in therapy as it does in the corporate area?
Yeah, I think so. No, I'm not a therapist, so I mean, too far beyond my level of expertise, but that sounds it's similar.
Right. So, you know, we get to a point where we've established that, you know, certain basic things need to happen to foster the old conversation. What do you do when you get to a place when you meet people who want to have those conversations but simply don't know how?
Yeah. So I think that you have to think about what are the conditions that you want to put into place to have those conversations. And so, you know, one of those conditions is just truly just commitment to keep the conversation going. To assume that the conversation may stay open, that you're not going to come to closure necessarily in one conversation because it is a discovery. It is about, you know, it is about learning. And so I think that, you know, an understanding that the commitment, you know, may take a while. You know, are you up for it? Do you really want to go into this? You really want to, because the topics that we're talking about are, you know, usually those topics that have been, you know, historically have been polarizing, historically have been, you know, have been difficult. When you start talking about inequities, when you start talking about things like oppression and privilege and all of those kinds of things, those are difficult topics to have. So you know, one is, you know, really commitment, and the second condition is, are you committed? So the part of the commitment is, are you committed to your own learning? Are you committed to really understanding who you are, why you believe what you believe, where those beliefs came from? Are you open to the perhaps to thinking that, well, maybe there's something else and I could change, you know, I could change my belief. Something else that's really important as a condition is to consider the power dynamics in the conversation. So if this is in the workplace and this is a difficult conversation, let's say in one of the examples I have in the book is that, let's say you're an African-American woman, you know, which I am, and I'm in the workplace and I don't think I've been treated fairly. I think that people have been promoted over me. And so I want to go to my boss and talk about, and I want to have a, you know, an effective, inclusive conversation about that, right? So I have to, first of all, really understand, you know, what are my triggers? You know, where am I emotionally? You know, how equipped am I to have this conversation? And the boss needs to acknowledge the power dynamic and to say right up front, you know, I recognize that in this conversation, you know, I have power. I can, you know, make decisions that, you know, impact your future. However, what I'd like to do is to try to create some equity here so that, in fact, you feel that your voice is just as important as my voice. So even stating it, even if it doesn't happen 100%, just the acknowledgement of the power dynamic, I think, is really critical for inclusive conversations.
It makes a lot of sense to me, too. Do you think that acknowledging the power dynamic is difficult for people in power to do?
I do. Absolutely. Very difficult for people in power, you know, to do. I think there's a couple of ways that people in power may respond. They may respond like, oh, you know, now, you know, just treat me as just, I'm, you know, just another colleague, right? Others may say, may like that power. they may want to continue to maintain that power dynamic.
Right, right. Well, and I think to some degree what you're talking about is the one of the core elements to what real leadership really is. Because leadership is not simply the person who makes the decisions and issues the agenda. There's more to it than that. And yet we don't really teach those skills, right? We don't teach those extra skills on human relationships. I'm shuddering as I use the word because there's so many problems with that term. But
right.
But you know, how do you put the humanity back into leadership, I guess, is the question.
Yeah, I mean, I think it's really difficult, and particularly today, you know, we're asking leaders to not only, you know, lead whatever functional area that they have and, you know, make the numbers work and all of that, but we're also asking them to understand diversity. We're also asking them to understand how it might be different for a woman in a historically male-dominated organization. Mm-hmm. What it might be for a person of color if they're the only person of color on your team. You know, so we're asking you to think about generations. And so are baby boomers shutting down the Gen Xers or the millennials? And so we're asking a lot of leaders today, not only, you know, to get the job done, but to also understand how these differences play out. So it's a lot.
Yeah, it is a lot. So could we go back and summarize? What would you say are the overall conditions for fostering inclusive conversations?
So yeah, so if we were to summarize that, I say, you know, the commitment to the, you know, to the long term, you know, being really self-aware, recognizing what some of the power dynamics are, and trying to create equity, trying to create a sense of inclusion and belonging in and of itself can be difficult. I think facing fear and fragility, that's one of the chapters, and so there's a lot of fear, and so even, you know, acknowledging that up front. This is not an easy conversation for me to have, and I do have some fear as I come into this conversation. Fragility is the term that was coined by Robin DiAngelo, you know, white fragility, and sort of this defensiveness that may come if someone who is in the minority or has been in a subordinated group has something that they feel is that they're not being treated fairly or something like that. It's easy to just become defensive and say, you know, well, we don't want, why are you calling the race card? Or, that really doesn't happen here. It hasn't been my experience, you know, so that defensiveness, can come into play, sort of in this fragile way of like, you know, don't question me, you know, because I'm not a racist, I'm not a sexist. And, you know, how could you, you know, think about even questioning me? So I think we've got to, you know, consider that. So that's one of the conditions, you know, knowing what our own triggers are, right?
Right.
One of the chapters in the book is, I spent a whole chapter on acknowledging whiteness, because when we're talking about dominant group and subordinated groups, you know, dominant group being the groups that, whether they're in the majority or not, they're in the position of power, and subordinated groups are those groups, obviously, that are not and have been subjected to inequitable inequitable treatment. And so Pew did a study, they do a study every year actually, but they asked the question, to what extent is your race core to your identity? 75% of African Americans said it was, 56% of Latinos said it was, 55% of Asians said it was, and only 15% of white people said that their race was core to their identity. And so when you're, when you don't even see it as core to your identity, it's hard to have a conversation because it's just not important to you. You don't get it. You don't get how race is determining and influencing and impacting your day to day in a different way than someone who is in the dominant group. It's like the fish in the fishbowl, right? Until you take it out of the fishbowl, the fish didn't know it was in there. So you've got this dominant culture all around, which is invisible. And so as long as it's invisible, then you can't really talk about it because it doesn't exist for the dominant group. That's what makes the conversations really, really difficult.
Mm-hmm.
And so those are, that's kind of in summary.
Yeah, no, it's excellent. I have too many questions at this point. Can the case for having these conversations always be traced back to business outcomes or to better business outcomes?
I think so, because think about it. If someone, let's just take it down to the very individual level.
Mm-hmm.
If I don't feel valued and respected, if I don't feel that I matter. So one of the chapters is creating a sense of inclusion and belonging. I did a very unscientific survey for the book, just asking people, you know, what does belonging mean to you? And I synthesized it, and it came right down to, you know, I matter. And so if people in the workplace don't think they matter, they're not going to give their best. They're not going to give their non-discretionary effort. You know, they may be just give the minimum, right? What I know I can do to get by. But why would I want to be innovative if I'm not feeling that I'm going to be valued anyway? You know, certain things happen in organizations, and this is a age-old one that's been talked about for years. And so a woman in a meeting says something, and everybody says, oh, and then 5 minutes later, a man says the same thing, and all of a sudden, oh, that's a great idea. And so, you know, the woman has been invalidated, right? And so what's our human tendency to do, right? Mm-hmm. Hey, I'm going to shut down. They don't want to hear what I have to say. And so, yeah, so you may be losing, you know, innovative ideas. And at the very extreme, it may look like sabotage, right? And people just may say, you know, I'm just so fed up that I am not being valued and respected that I'm just going to, you know, do the counter. You know? And that's right. That, I think many people do that, but I'm just saying that that could be the outcome if, in fact, individuals don't feel that they're valued, that they're respected, that their contribution, you know, matters.
Right. And I'm sure not the least of which is time. I mean, if you have an environment where people are comfortable talking and bringing things up in the first place, those innovations may hit the table much faster than otherwise.
Absolutely. You waste a lot of time trying to, yeah, right, exactly.
Yeah.
Getting to that place of trust. We talk about trust in the book as well. I can trust you with my ideas, mm-hmm. and know that you're going to, you know, honor them and not, you know, misuse them.
Mary Frances, how do you think that the current political climate is affecting or changing the way we have conversations like this?
Oh my goodness, it's changed it a lot because there's so much in the media that is fostering polarization. There's so much in the media that's fostering the us and the them, and putting labels and putting putting negative labels on certain groups. So I think that people are coming into the workplace sometimes fearful on not knowing, you know, perhaps what political side is my coworker on, right?
Right.
So I think that can be very, very difficult. And so if you don't have an organization that's open and willing to talk about it, so inclusion means that we include, you know, that it's okay for somebody to have a conservative opinion. It's okay for somebody to have, you know, a liberal leaning, but, you know, how do we respect that? And in the workplace, if it comes up, I'm not suggesting that we start these kinds of conversations in the workplace. However, how do we have a meaningful and a respectful conversation when we're on, you know, political, we're at political opposites? And so at some level, just the ability to hear why somebody else may feel as strongly on the conservative side as somebody on the liberal side can break down some barriers. If it's not handled properly, which is why I wrote the book, it can just exacerbate the polarization.
Right. I'm wondering if there are concrete things that we as individuals can do to stop that influence from the media and from other externals. How do we not give in to polarization? Because I ask that simply because that I have tried to do that before in my own circles, and it is difficult. It is difficult when people have sort of set up their camps and are sort of firing shots at each other already.
Exactly. Yeah. So I think one of the things we have to do, if we're in a conversation, if it's a structured conversation that has been set up, you know, for this rather than a spontaneous conversation where something just kind of comes up, you can set the, you know, we can set the ground rules, right? We know that there's polarization. And so, you know, set it up that way. We already know. And what we're not trying to do here is debate. So I talk about the difference between debate and dialogue. We often think we are dialoguing when we're actually debating. And in debating, there's a winner and a loser. You know, remember high school debates and college debates, political debates, right? Who won the debate? And so in these kinds of conversations, we're not trying to win, we're trying to learn. And so if we, you know, establish that initially, that that's one of the, you know, we want to make sure that we're maintaining a dialogue space and not a debate space. And we're going to, you know, check each other on that. We have to set the rule that I am open to hearing an idea that is diametrically opposed to what I believe, and I will listen to it before I respond to it. And I think so setting up those kinds of ground rules at the beginning and saying, you know, is there anybody here who, you know, really can't abide by these ground rules, and you're invited to, you know, you're invited to leave.
Right. Right. That's the point where I'm sort of not wanting to go to, because I feel like if I get to that point, then I have failed in my own communicative agenda. Asking someone to leave means the conversation really has fallen apart.
Mm-hmm. Right. Yeah.
So
and maybe just for that moment, you know, maybe there would be another time to reconvene when those conditions could be.
Yeah. Adhered. Yeah, absolutely. Exactly. That's what we all hope for. This is fascinating stuff. I think we could talk about this all day. I on a personal note, I have to ask you, how long did it take you to put together the book?
Maybe 6 months.
Wow. That's fantastic.
Is that a long time?
I don't know. I've been struggling with the book idea for over a year and a half now. So,
well, I have a publisher, Barrett Kohler Publishers, and they push me. Are you writing? they give me all sorts of deadlines.
That's amazing. So the thing we try to do with the Inclusion Catalyst is always end the episode with some call to action. And in this case, I think the call to action is obviously to encourage people to check out Inclusive Conversations. Where can people find that book? Where can they order your other titles?
So on Amazon, Inclusive Conversations is ready for pre-order. It drops August 1st. So that's when the book will actually be published, but it is available for pre-order. We Can't Talk About That at Work is also that's available now on Amazon or at our website, www.wintersgroup.com. So yeah, those would be the best places to find the books.
I can't wait to read them in full. Is there anything else we should cover today before we wrap this episode?
I just wanted to say to those who may be listening who are dealing with COVID-19 that I just want to wish everybody well and hope that people are healthy as we go through this difficult time in our society.
Amen. Thank you. Yes, we hope everybody's contending well with it. And Mary Frances, thank you for taking the time to make this recording with me today.
Absolutely. Thank you for inviting me. I really appreciate it.
And to our listeners, thank you for joining us for this episode. We value your feedback and comments, which you can reach us via our own website, inclusioncatalyst.com. In the meantime, stay safe. We'll see you with another episode soon.
And that's it for this episode of Inclusion Catalyst. If you enjoyed it, please subscribe and share with your friends and colleagues.